This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Strange things about this week's Sedra is the placing of all the dinim of the identification of kosher and non-kosher animals. The Sedra really is dealing with very complicated, the whole of Vayikra deals with very complicated laws of the temple service. And we've just dealt with the death of the two sons of Aharon as a result of them not having observed the instructions of the temple service with sufficient meticulousness. And then it launches into this whole parsha that deals with how to identify kosher animals and non-kosher animals, and to lists and lists of animals that we may eat and that we may not eat. The basic laws of kashrus in terms of kosher and non-kosher animals are all contained at the end of this parsha. The Medrash is worried about something else. The Medrash Tanchuma is worried about something else concerning the laws of kashrus. And what worries the Medrash is actually very basic, not just to the laws of kashrus, but to all the dinim of the Torah, to the whole principle of halachas of the Torah. What bothers the Medrash is really a very simple thing. The Medrash says it's not fair. Why are we governed so severely and strictly, and the non-Jews have it easy? Non-Jew can go into any restaurant he wants, and he can eat to his heart's content, and after he's had his meat, he wants milk, he can have milk, he wants cream, he can have cream, whatever he wants. And we, there's nowhere to eat, and eventually after decades there's one restaurant, two restaurants in Johannesburg that we can go to. So where are we? We want to take our wives out for dinner, so where can we go? We can go to a restaurant. The next week maybe another restaurant. A month later we're back at the first restaurant. And we see each other there, always see each other there. There's not much choice. What kind of a life is this for a Jew? We're supposed to be the chosen people. Is that how it's supposed to be? After dinner, the evening's still young. So what do the goyim do? They go out to see movies, and they go and see what they like, and they do what they like, and they enjoy it. After the movie, it's still time. It's a Saturday night. Tomorrow night's not a working day. They go to a nightclub, have a good time, and after that somewhere else for coffee, and they have a wonderful time. And we, the wonderful chosen people, comes the Motzei Shabbos, we sit in the shir. After the shir, if we want to go out, if it should happen that after the shir we all want to go out for dinner tonight, we're all going to meet the same, we're all going to be at the same place. And after that, nothing, come home. What kind of a life is that for a chosen people? Such heavy restrictions. And Rabbi Tanchuma, in the Medrash Tanchuma, sort of declares out, "Hiti lohem v'sa'asurim v'sa'ashkotzim v'sa'aramoshim." It's not fair for them. They can eat everything which is treif, and they can eat all the shkotzim and all the ramoshim, all the creepy crawly things they can eat as well. And you know, we develop a sort of a distaste for creepy crawly things, but in some countries there are delicacies, and among many people there are delicacies. What can we eat? The same pieces of meat, the same types of animals, all the same, very boring and monotonous, and forces the women to be ingenious in their cooking and dressing up of the same food in very many different ways. But there's not all that much of a choice that a Jew has. Moshal l'maha dovar doime. So the Tanchuma gives a moshal, he gives a story to explain the principle involved. L'roife, a doctor. Sheholach l'vakeh beis chole. On his rounds in the hospital, and there are two sick people lying next to one another. He looks at one who's severely ill. So he writes there on his records there, says he can eat a diet, anything he pleases. Goes on to the next one. He looks at the next one, also seriously ill, but he sees this one's going to come straight. Lists a whole list of things that he can eat and a whole list of things that he can't eat. Amr al-Rofe Mazet, the nurses come to the doctor and they said, "What's going on? Which one is more severely ill? This one you let him, he can eat whatever he wants, and this one you let, he's got to say severely restricted. The one who's more seriously ill, you let him eat what he wants." Amr al-Rofe, says the doctor, This one's going to live, I've got to be careful with him. This you can eat, and this you can't eat. But the other one is going to die. He's not going to come out of this. So it doesn't really matter what he eats. He can eat what he wants. That's what the Medrash Tanchuma says, which is a heavy Medrash. The principle of the Medrash is that restrictions are an expression of who you are, not an imposition onto what you are. Restrictions don't restrict you. They are created by your very being. The author from Slabodka gives an example. He says, you know, if we eat a little piece of meat which is not quite fresh, we get a stomach ache. And if a chazer eats a piece of meat which isn't fresh, it doesn't get a stomach ache. If we eat milk which has gone off, it can affect us. Give it to an animal to eat, doesn't affect it. When the Gemara wants to describe food which is no longer fit for any form of consumption, it says lo royil achilas kelev. It's not fit for a dog to eat. Dogs, there are many things that a dog can eat and survive on that we can't eat and survive on. Is that because to say that's unfair? The dog can eat it, we can't. It's rotten. That's why the dog can eat it. It doesn't affect the dog, but it's rotten, and that's why we can't eat it. The restrictions that are placed upon us by the Torah are an expression of our tremendous sensitivity to things which are spiritually slightly off. And when one is allowed to eat it, it is because one isn't that spiritually sensitive. And I take a man who works all day with delicate scales and balances in a laboratory with chemicals and these very fancy electrical scales and balances. And imagine when he walks in the market, goes to the market early one morning to buy groceries for his wife, and he sees them throw these things onto the scales. Imagine how it jars him. Can you treat a scale like that? Can't throw things on. He's used to putting things on with tweezers gently, and here they're throwing pounds and tons of things onto scales. Depends on the scale. Some scales are built to take such a battery, and some scales are so fine that you can only put certain things onto them and only certain weights on them, and one has to be very careful in handling them, otherwise one can destroy them. You can take a knife and you can cut a piece of butter or cheese with it, it doesn't blunt on the knife. Take the knife of a shochet and just cut a piece of meat with it or a piece of butter with it, and he has to go sharpening it again for hours. What's the difference? Unfair. Here's a different kind of knife. The measure of sensitivity of that knife is different to an ordinary kitchen knife. And here we have a yesod, the whole principle of the limitations of religious behavior. Of course we are limited. Of course there are things we cannot do, but it's not things we cannot do, it's things we cannot tolerate. And that's what has to be understood. Unfortunately, in physical things, it's easier for us to gauge ourselves what we can tolerate and what we can't, because we get sick when we can't tolerate something. But in spiritual terms, our level of tolerance is not easily measurable by ourselves. Sometimes, but when we get to be able to measure it, it's too late, the damage is done already. There was a time, I'm sure, and not all that long ago, when people could in fact feel the damage that these things do to one. And even today, if one is on some reasonable spiritual level, there are forms of tumor that one is actually sensitive to, that one actually feels that it does one harm and one keeps away from them. And therefore, the laws of kashrus, the laws that restrict that which we may and may not eat, are laws which are an expression of our chayus, of our being sensitively alive. In fact, Rashi, based on the same medrash, says it on the words, Zois hachayo asher toichlu. These are the animals which you may eat. Now, chayo means an animal, and chayo also means life. Says Rashi, Zois hachayo loshun chayim. That's the life. Zois hachayo means this is the life. The fish Yisrael devukim babakum uruim leishayim, because of the Jews' close relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam and their fitness for life, they have to be more sensitive. You have a fitness fanatic. He doesn't do the things that we all do. He doesn't eat the things that we do. He doesn't smoke the things that we do. He doesn't sleep the way that we do. Everything he does differently. Why? You say, must I also do that? He said, no, it's alright for you. You can carry on doing the way you are. It's okay. So why are you different? Why are you so fanatical and you're so particular about how you eat and what you eat? I'm a fitness fanatic. So we're fitness fanatics when it comes to spiritual life. That's what we are. We take it very seriously. It's something very close to us and something very special to us. And as a consequence, it does create limitations on us. The being fit for life is what creates those limitations. And this is something which is hard to appreciate and to live with. Because we're used to seeing Torah as something very quantitative, something very measurable, as a thing. And when you're dealing with things, with objects, it doesn't really matter that much what the kli is, what the utensil is that holds them. But when you're dealing with more subtle things, when you're dealing with energy, for example, you can't just transfer a flame onto anything. Some things don't burn. Some things burn better. Some things make smoke when they burn. Some things don't make smoke. Some things will give a pure light. Some won't give a pure light. Depends really. When you're working with energy, when you're working with something subtle, you can't just say, it doesn't matter. Put it there, put it there. It doesn't work like that. You've got to be careful with it. It's got to go in the right place. If you put it in the wrong place, it gets extinguished. You lose the energy. And Torah is not an object. It's not a bag of oranges that you can just put in anything and it will hold it. In the case of Torah, if the kli, if the utensil, is not sufficiently well attuned, it won't hold the Torah. And the Torah just disappears altogether. It's not that you can, there's such a thing as tumah, and there's such a thing as kedusha. There's such a thing as impurity, and there's such a thing as purity. And a person can have so much purity, so much impurity. It doesn't work like that. The one drives the other out. You can't have them both together. It's like air and water. Push the air in, the water will go out. Put the water in, the air goes out. You can't just say, well, I have half the glass full of air and half the glass full of water down the side. It doesn't work like that. As full as there's water, there's no air. And above the water level, there's no water. And that's how it is with Torah. Where there's tumor, there's no Torah. Where there's Torah, there's no tumor. They can't go together. They can't function together. But it goes a little bit further than that. This requirement that we have to be, that the utensil has to be fit for use, of a Torah, that the human body has to be fit for use, is something which applies not only to what we eat, but also to who we are. Rabbeinu Yonah says the following in the third chapter of Pirkei Avos on the statement that im ein derech eretz ein Torah. If there's no derech eretz, and Rabbeinu Yonah takes derech eretz kipshuto, just meaning just that. Derech eretz, mensch lachai. If there's no derech eretz, ain Torah, there can be no Torah. Ritzoinu lomar, listen to the words carefully. Shetzorich techila letaken es atzmoi b'midos. Before trying to absorb Torah, it is necessary to fix yourself with midos. It is necessary to improve one's midos, to improve one's character, before one starts learning. In fact, this is a continuation of a discussion which we started at the late issue this morning, where the question was raised of the ability of the Torah to affect the character of a human being. And we discussed that it's not quite so simple, that whereas Torah can improve a mensch, it cannot make a mensch. And says Rabbeinu Yonah, "Shetzorich she tchilo letaken es atzmo b'midos." First, there's got to be midos. When there are midos, then then the Torah will settle on one. Torah is like snow. It's very gentle, but there has to be the right surface for it to settle and to stick there. Otherwise it just melts, it hits the ground and it disappears, it changes, it goes off. The surface has to be right that collects it. The utensil has to be right before you start. Otherwise one layer after the other disappears. If the surface is right, then one layer comes and it settles. And another layer comes and it settles, and very quickly you've got it looking beautiful and all covered in snow. So it is here, v'zeh tishko na Torah olov. And then if there are basic midas, the Torah will settle on him. Slowly it will build him up. She'ineno shoychenes lo'olov. Beguf she'inoi bal midas toivos. Because the Torah will never settle on a body which is not possessed by a man of good character. An amazing statement of Rabbeinu Yonah. Because the Torah will never settle beguf on a body she'eino bal midas toivos, which is not possessed by somebody of good character. Lo shiyilmoid ha'Torah v'achakach yikach lo ha'mitzvos. not. It's not the other way around. The start of learning and then the mitzvahs and the middles will come later. Ki e'epsha, this is impossible, says Rav Enigan. It doesn't work that way. The procedure is first you become a mensch and then you learn Torah. V'zeu kinyan shenema na'aseh v'nishma k'moshe k'sadna. And that's pshat on Shavuos when we say na'aseh v'nishma. Incredible limud of Rabbeinu Yonah in na'aseh v'nishma. The old question, na'aseh v'nishma means we will do and then we'll hear. The old question is, how can you do before you know what to do? What do you mean na'aseh v'nishma? Yes, Rabbeinu Yonah, we'll keep the Torah. Now, nishma will tell us what it says inside it. What do you mean? How can you keep it before you know what it says? Says Rabbeinu Yonah, there are certain parts of the Torah that you don't need the Torah to teach you. There are certain parts of the Torah that you can keep before you have a Torah. And not which you can keep before you have the Torah, says Rabbeinu Yonah, which you have to keep before you have the Torah. And e'efsha without that, you cannot learn Torah without that. And we in fact discussed this morning that although today this isn't really practiced, regretfully, Torah is fairly public and open today. People are enticed to come and learn Torah nowadays. Advertisements and billboards and it's become almost like the entertainment world in a sense. It's a matter of attracting people to learn Torah, which is something we needed to do very, very drastically immediately after the Second World War, where there just weren't people learning Torah. And in order to re-establish Torah in the world as quickly as possible, it was necessary to become very unselective and to be very grateful for anybody who was prepared to learn Torah. Remember the atmosphere which must have prevailed in that time, 1945, 1950, 1955, Torah was not a popular subject, and there were very few teachers, very few students. And when one thinks how that has been turned around in such a short time, how today in every country in the Western world, and not only in the Western world, one finds people learning and teaching Torah on a meaningful level, one realizes the tremendous amount of progress quantitatively which has taken place in, 30, 40 years and nothing. Where a whole generation has been re-established starting from nothing. However, it had to be done at the sacrifice of selectivity. In the old times, and by old times we're talking only pre-war, it was very difficult to get into a yeshiva. And the better the yeshiva, the more difficult it was to get in. There were very long waiting lists. There were many requirements that had to be met before one could come in. Very seldom was the requirement a high standard of learning. The yeshiva would give you a high standard of learning. That they were never worried about. A person who didn't know very much, they could teach. That wasn't their problem. They were worried about the kind of people that you can't teach. As Rabbeinu Yonah says, e'efsha. There's such a thing as a person that you can't teach. He can't learn. Why doesn't he learn? Because Torah is given to human beings. One has to be a mensch before this. That na'aseh v'nishma, there's a certain part of Torah which has to be practiced before you start. And if that isn't being practiced, then the Torah altogether cannot be taught effectively. And even in the present yeshivish world, and certainly up till recently, it wasn't that easy to get into the good yeshivas. It wasn't a simple matter. But that's certainly how it is meant to be. The difficulty which the ladies cornered me on, and which I'm going to try and explain a little bit further tonight, is they said, okay, but then you must define what it means, what those parts of the Torah are. What does it mean to be a mensch? And I tried to get out of it every way I could think of, and I accused one lady without accusing her herself. I said, look, if you ask what it means to be a mensch, it means you don't know what it is to be a mensch. How can you ask such a question? She wouldn't take that still. She wants to know the definition. What does it mean to be a mensch? I said, it's one of these things, indefinable. A mensch is a mensch. No, they wouldn't take that either. It's got to be defined. If it's so critical, this is your entrance requirement to Torah. How do you define whether a man is a mensch or not? And we reached a bit of a definition, which I think is correct, and which we'll find, in fact, in the Sedra. This concept, that it's not only what you do which affects the degree to which Torah can stick to you, but also who you are, is a concept that we find in the parasha immediately preceding the parasha of the kasher, the treif animals. And that's what's so interesting. Immediately preceding is that parasha of the sons of Aaron, who did the wrong thing and they died. And then the bodies are taken away and the korbanos are brought, and Moshe expresses anger at the way a particular law was handled. And Moshe asked, now where is the Seir, the goat that was brought as the Chatat offering? And he found that it had been burnt. And then he got angry at them and he said, why didn't you eat the Korban Chatas? It shouldn't have been burnt, it should have been eaten. And he got angry with them. Vayadaber Aaron el Moshe. And Aaron came to Moshe, he took the responsibility, my responsibility, and he said, Hein hayoim ikrivu es chatosum veselosum lifnei Hashem. Today they brought their korbanos before Hashem, vatikreno isi ko'ele. And a tragedy has befallen me. I've lost two sons today. Vochalti chatos hayoim. And I'm going to eat the korban chatos today. Hayitav veinei Hashem. Would Hashem be very happy with that? I'm an oinen, I'm in the position of aninus. There's been a death and not yet a funeral. I'm an oinen and I'm not allowed to eat korbanos. Vayishma Moshe vayitav veinei. And Moshe heard and he conceded. And didn't Moshe know that an oinen isn't allowed to eat from a korban? Didn't Moshe know that Aaron and his family in this position that they weren't permitted to eat? What did Aaron teach Moshe that he didn't know before? Say Chazal, of course Moshe knew, but he forgot. And the Medrash Rabbah says this is one of the three cases where Moshe forgot certain halachas. One wonders, how is it possible? If we forget a halacha, we feel terribly bad about it. Moshe Rabbeinu, to forget a halacha. And it's not simple halachas. It's not little tiny halachas. It's not little details of halachas. It's a whole major area of halacha that Moshe Rabbeinu just completely forgot. How is that possible? And what right does he have to get angry? Surely if one forgets something, you feel that maybe that you're not 100% sure. You can't get angry that somebody is not doing it the way you think it's supposed to be. Surely you feel that there's something forgotten, Sister Midrash? No. It's because he got angry that he forgot, not the other way around. In the Midrash, you can't learn Torah when you're angry. You can't know Torah when you're angry. You can't remember Torah when you're angry. Torah doesn't stick to a person at times of anger, at moments of anger. And here we see that exact same concept. The Torah only affects and takes and functions in a person who follows not only a certain style of behavior, but a certain style of character. And a certain style of menschlichkeit. Not chas v'sholem to suggest for a moment that Moshe was anything else but the greatest. But at the three times when he got angry, what did he get angry over? Not because anybody had done anything wrong to him. He got angry because he felt the halacha was not being carried out properly. He got angry because of something that was done. That anger, even that anger, that little moment of anger, which must have been very small and very quick in Moshe Rabbeinu. Because if anybody could control themselves and if anybody had mastered themselves to the nth degree, it was Moshe Rabbeinu. And yet to teach us that there is no exception to this law, that no matter how clearly you know your Torah, no matter how where your Torah has been learnt, what Rebbe you have, who did Moshe Rabbeinu have as his Rebbe? God, Moshe Rabbeinu, the Ribbono Shel Olam. No matter what yeshiva you learnt, and you can learn by the Ribbono Shel Olam speak. You can know the Torah so clearly that nobody will ever know it as clearly as that. Still, a moment of anger can cause a mistake because the Torah doesn't stick where there's been anger. These two parshas, which we've now connected together, the animals which we may and may not eat, and the anger of Moshe, and we've connected them together to show that what we eat and what we don't eat affects our spirituality, and how we behave affects our spirituality. There's also a much more basic and a much deeper understanding, I think, between these two parshas. The example we have in the first parsha is kas, anger. However we understand Moshe's moment of anger, but it's described as vayiktzeh, as he became angry. The second one is eating. It's interesting, those of you who come to the Shalashudas Shir, to the Vilna Gaon Shir, will remember the Vilna Gaon dividing all misdeeds into two basic categories. He called them female categories. The male categories he called the ka'asoni, and the female category the ta'avoni. Ka'asoni means those averas, those misdeeds which are motivated by anger, and the ta'avoni, those misdeeds which are motivated by desire. The male motivation is the anger, and the female motivation is the desire. That doesn't mean that all men get angry and all women have desire. It just means that in every human being there are motivations which have female characteristics and motivations which have male characteristics. And we describe that a little bit further as being the emotions of aggression and of desire. And the Vilna Gaon said that is the yesod of loy tiltach and loy tinach, the two prohibitions in the Ten Commandments: thou shalt not murder and thou shalt not be sexually immoral. Represent these two categories which cover all the areas of misdeeds, says the Vilna Gaon. This kasoni and tavoni is something that we also discussed this morning with the ladies, in a sense. I described to the ladies the importance when in America of paying a visit to Universal Studios, because one learns there a very important life principle. One learns there that you can feel movement without moving. That's a very important episode in Universal Studios. I described to them how they take you in a train over a rickety bridge, and then all of a sudden there's a big noise and the bridge collapses and you feel yourself falling into a deep ravine, and it's a very, very frightening experience. But you're not falling at all, you're not moving at all. The train is just shaking a little bit and the props on the side are going up, that's all that's happening. And you feel yourself dropping, but you're really stationary. And there are various such things, and they show you how they do that in the movies. But it's not really a car moving along the highway and they're busy filming the car. The car's stationary, they show you them doing it. The highway's moving, the car's still. It spoils one's appreciation afterwards of that form of art, that I must say. But that they show you. I remember also commenting, I think I mentioned to you, in a drosha in America soon after that, that the jacuzzi was a further extension of the same principle. That it creates the sensation of movement without having to move. And so it was a brilliant idea. Instead of you having to exert the energy of moving through water, they let you sit on a chair and the water passes through you. That's it. You feel as if you're swimming, you feel as if you're moving. You're not moving at all, you're sitting, but it's the same sensation. And the Americans are very clever at creating sensations without requiring too much effort. And in Torah we have the same thing. There is the sensation of progress in Torah without really moving, and there is in life the sensation of progress without really moving. Let's say one starts off a business, and in the first year of business one's turnover is 1,000 rand, in the second year it's 100,000 rand, in the third year it's 1,000,000, fourth year 1,000,000, fifth year 1,000,000, sixth year 1,000,000. You're not moving, you're getting frustrated and you're becoming aggressive in your marketing and you're doing all sorts of clever things. Sticks 1,000,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000, nothing changes. All of a sudden one of your competitors drop out, another one of your competitors drop out. The progress we're making, we're really moving, and the last competitor drops, it's still you doing 1,000,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000, but you feel you're progressing. What's creating that illusion of progress when you're really sitting in exactly the same position? You've seen others fall by the way, so you think you're moving up. That's all it is. Why do we do wrong? What's the yesod? What is the foundation of the Vilna Gaon's principle of the kasoni and the tavoni? We like to feel potent. We like to feel alive. One of the greatest threats that faces the human being is the threat of his own fatality. The knowledge that he's not going to last. The knowledge that he's on the way out from the moment he was born. The knowledge that it's all over afterwards. Especially when we leave aside any considerations of an olam haba, of a life after death. And there's a constant striving for eternity, a constant fight to try and feel alive, to try and feel that I'm real. And there are two ways that I can feel alive. I can feel alive by the effect the world has on me, and I can feel alive by the effect that I have on the world. If I can experience the world, I must be alive, and it's a nice feeling. And if I can affect the world, I also must be alive, and it's a nice feeling. And that's the kasoni and the tavoni. The kasoni is to affect the world when I want to feel alive, and we're not using mitzvahs as the means of doing it. The kasoni is I affect the world, I experience my potency by a destructiveness. If I can destroy something, I must be somebody. It's not possible for a nothing, for a nobody, for a nebulous thing to destroy. And I feel my power and my potence through destruction. The tavoni is the other way around. If I can experience something nice, if I can taste good food, If I can enjoy a nice sensation, I must be alive. Something that doesn't exist can't enjoy these kinds of things. So the Kasoni goes, it's from me outward, acting in the world in a destructive way, and the Tavoni is from me inward, actually taking something in from the world and experiencing the result, experiencing the consequence. What emerges though is something very interesting. If we will say then that these are the two things we're being taught, that the human being has to be pure in order to be mekabel Torah, in order to be able to receive Torah and be affected by Torah, he needs to be pure. He needs to be pure in the sense of the kas. Only if you're angry, we see from Moshe Rabbeinu, even for a fleeting second, the Torah doesn't stick by you. And one needs to be free, one needs to be pure in the ta'avoni, in one's eating. Eating representing the ta'avoni, taking from the world and experiencing the sensation of eating. There also one needs purity. But it emerges that there is one very great difference. The kasoni, you're not allowed to practice at all. Moshe was just a little bit angry for a moment on a halachic matter, and that wasn't accepted. That was out. Whereas the Tavoni, we're told, no, just certain things you can't eat. You can't eat a chazan, you can't eat a camel, you can't eat a horse, you can't eat prawns, but you can eat cows, and you can eat sheep, and you can eat oxen, and you can eat calves, and you can eat goats, and you can eat kudus, and you can eat impalas. There are many things you can eat, only some things you can't eat. And that is very interesting, because it's in fact Paschim like that. Out of all the middos, out of all the characteristics, the Rambam lists two, arrogance and kas, as the ones which have to be completely annihilated. One isn't permitted to have them at all. The Rambam's whole theory of his golden mean is that middo, the word that we use for characteristics, in every language you've got words like virtues and vice. Good middos and bad middos, virtue and vice. In Torah there's no such word. There's midah tova and midah ra, a good midah and a bad midah. And what does midah mean? Says the Rambam, it means measure. So all we can use is a good measure and a bad measure. What does that mean? Says the Rambam, it depends. We need a bit of everything in the right measures. If you've got a good measure of kindness, it's good. If you've got a bad measure of kindness, too much or too little, it's bad. If you've got a good measure of cruelty, you know how to use it where you have to, that's good. If you've got no cruelty or too much cruelty, that's bad. It's a matter of proportion. And that's why the word used is mizah, midah, measurement, and midah tova, midah ra, not virtue and vice, two completely different words that we don't have. It's one midah, and it depends how much of it you contain. But kaas, anger, nothing, says the Rambam. You're not permitted to have it at all. And we see that here in the pasuk. That for anger, even a little bit of anger, the Torah leaves you. When it comes to taiva, I want to eat, I want to satisfy my appetite, you're allowed to, as long as one does it correctly. There are laws over what you can eat, and there are laws over when you can eat, and there are laws over how you eat. And provided those laws are adhered to, eating is permissible. We in fact had that in the Vilna Gaon as well. Those of you will remember that there is a way where the Tavoni can be expressed, but the Kasoni, the aggressive nature in a human being, cannot be expressed at all. I want to take that idea one step further. My brother in America gave a shiur a couple of years ago in which he said that the natural and logical consequence of the permissive society is going to be the permissiveness of incest and bestiality and so on. And at that time it was absurd. It was an absolutely absurd suggestion. That incest would become legalized and normal was absolutely no. People laughed at that. Ridiculous. And my brother asked me what I thought of it, and I agreed. I said, it's a very clear observation. What's the difference? Why are you going to stop here? It was only later that I found in the Vilna Gaon, where the Vilna Gaon says that all the laws of the Ta'avoni are Bein Odom Lemokom, they're not Bein Odom Lechaver. These are all laws that concern the man-God relationship. Because one of the arguments that is now being put forward, and by the way, in certain Scandinavian countries, incest was recently legalized. And one of the arguments that is being put forward is it doesn't do anybody harm, but adults, consenting adults, whose business is it? Nobody's causing harm in society. That's a valid claim. The kasoni is the only thing that society has to stamp out if you leave God out of it. The aggressive act. I must be able to walk in the street in peace. I must be able to be left alone. I must be left to get on with my work. If there's aggression against me, that is a problem that society has to stamp out. Any society has to stamp out. You can't have such a thing. Society cannot operate if people are going to steal from each other and rob from one another and murder one another. You can't operate like that. And those are those, the Rambam says in the Shmoneh Prokim, are things which... Okay, I'll come back to that in a moment. But the Tavoni, two people want to have a good time together. They're not causing anybody any harm. Is it society's business to interfere because we happen to think it's immoral? They don't think it's immoral. It's their business. And they're right. If you don't have a God and you don't have a Torah, why shouldn't two consenting adults do what they want if they're not harming anybody else? It comes out with the understanding that the whole area of the Ta'avoni, the whole area of those wrongs which are motivated by a desire rather than by aggression, are Bein Adam L'Makom, those concern a man-God relationship. Not a man-man relationship. That's why it's ridiculous when people often say, I want to be moral without being religious. Leave the formal side of Torah alone, I'm a moral man. I don't believe in God, but in interpersonal relationships I'm moral. That simply means I'm not aggressive. That means I don't cheat and I don't murder and I don't steal. That's all it means. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I am moral in cases where nobody suffers from my immorality. Because we believe that morality and immorality is not just where people are suffering. It is possible to be immoral even when nobody suffers. Even to tell a lie behind closed doors, we consider immoral. If I were to close the doors, nobody were to hear me, and I were to say something so preposterous as "it is now daytime," that is immoral. It's a distortion of truth. Nobody suffers as a result of it. I suffer as a result of it. And it's the Torah's business to protect me by restricting me. And that's the essence of morality, not just to protect one another from each other, but to protect you from you and to protect me from me. But for that there has to be a God. Otherwise, who's going to protect me from me? How am I going to know what is damaging to me? And therefore again, the Ka'asoni has to be out completely. There's no way that can ever be tolerated, the aggressiveness. The Ta'avoni, where one wants things that aren't one's own perhaps, there are ways that it can be done, there are times that it can be done under specific circumstances. The Rambam says, somebody in fact asked me at the Kiddush this morning about the Gemara that says it is wrong to have an attitude about, say, trade food. That, oh, I couldn't eat pork. That's not the right attitude. The right attitude is, oh, I would love to. What can I do? The Torah says, no, I don't do it. That's the correct attitude. Not, oh, prawns, I couldn't eat them. The right attitude to the Gemara is, Efshi, I could. And that might be very delicious, but the Rebbeinu Shem has commanded me not to do it. The Torah's restrictions are not there to make us despise the world. The Torah's restrictions are only there to govern our relationship with the world, but not to create negative feelings in the world. Okay, sometimes we have to have negative feelings against actions, but we don't have negative feelings against nature. Nothing which the Ribbono Shel Olam made do we have to have a negative feeling to, and a despising attitude to. We have to be critical, we have to see things for what they're for. We don't love chazerim. A pig is not something that the Jewish people have really had a very endearing relationship with at any stage in their history. We're disgusted with him a little bit, but still that doesn't mean that we wouldn't eat him if there wasn't a mitzvah in the Torah. We probably would. If it wasn't in the Torah, we would. Says the Rambam, that's true for most laws, but there are certain dinim which one would keep even without the Torah. Certain dinim which we would keep even without the Torah. And that, says the Rambam, basically what emerges in the Shmoneh Prokim are the Ka'asoni laws, the aggressive laws. That you don't need the Torah to tell you to do. Not to be aggressive to other people, not to murder, not to steal, not to cheat, not to cause other people pain and suffering, for that you don't need the Torah. Because that's a simple principle. If I cause that to him and nobody stops me, the next day somebody else causes it to me and nobody will stop them. So it's simple logic that we've got to stop that. With or without a Torah, it makes no difference. The society must stop it. What emerges is that we then have the definition of that part of Torah which we would have to keep even without the Torah being given. This nice evanishma, which the Rabbeinu Yonah says that there are certain parts of Torah which you must be keeping before you start learning Torah. And the ladies this morning tried to corner me, and successfully, and they said, what are those parts of Torah? What exactly do we need to keep before we start learning? The answer is the Kaasoni. All those laws which fit into the prohibitions motivated by aggression, that you're not allowed to do before you start learning Torah, because you don't need Torah for that. And if before you start learning you're aggressive and you hurt people and you steal and rob from people and cause them suffering, why do you do it? You can't say, because I don't know it's wrong. You're doing it because you're an animal, you have an uncontrollable aggression in you. So what's Torah going to help you? Torah will just tell you more things you're not allowed to do and you won't be able to control it. So why start learning? When you can control your own aggression, which everybody knows they have to do, then you're fit to start learning Torah. It makes perfect sense not to teach Torah to a person before he's reached that stage. And I brought them the Gemara of the non-Jew who came to Hillel and said, Hillel, Reb Hillel, please teach me the Torah while I'm standing on one leg. And you know that he asked Shammai the question before, and Shammai kicked him out and asked such ridiculous questions. You can't, the Torah is too complex. And Hillel took the challenge. And I always point out that if Hillel took the challenge and he later converted him, he must have realized that the question was a very serious and intelligent question. If he was just mocking, if this non-Jewish person was just mocking, teach me the Torah while I stand on one leg, Hillel would never have converted him later on. So what was he asking? I said he was asking the same question as the ladies were asking this morning. And Shammai, they managed to corner. Hillel, they didn't. His question was, look, Reb Hillel, I'm coming into Torah. You're telling me before I come into Torah, I've got to be a mensch. What is a mensch? According to the definition of Torah, you've got to teach me Torah to tell me. You're not allowed to teach me Torah until I'm a mensch. So what's going to happen? How am I going to learn? Where are we going to start? I need one simple formula, one rule that I can grasp and keep in my mind and behave according to that rule, and I know that then I'm involved in Torah. So it's Hillel, simple, easy. He doesn't say love your neighbor as yourself. For that you need Torah. That's the principle of Torah already. To love your neighbor as yourself, that means figuring out and doing things for people, doing mitzvahs. It involves chesed, and it involves tzedakah, and it involves aknotas orchim, and it involves all sorts of mitzvahs. For that you've got to know Torah already. So he can't tell the non-Jew, v'ahavta l'rayacha kamoicha. So he tells him that don't do to others what you don't like done to yourself. That's all. That's the basis of a mensch. That you're able to live for that, you don't need Torah. You know what you don't like done to yourself. You don't need Torah for that. So if you're able to stop doing to others what you don't want done to yourself, then you're a basic mensch. That means you know how to control yourself. Once you know how to control yourself, come into Torah, and we'll slowly teach you more and more mitzvahs, more and more halachas, which you'll be able to keep because you have basic control over yourself. But until you can't keep, until you're able, at the point where you're still unable to restrain yourself from doing to others what you wouldn't want done to yourself, at that point there's no point in learning Torah. That means you're unable to control your basic aggression, in which case you're unable to take on new laws. And this we see in the two parashas of the Seder from which we started. A little bit of chaos, just a little bit from Moshe Rabbeinu, from the great, great Moshe Rabbeinu. And a little bit of Torah is forgotten. A little bit of Torah departs from him. There can be no chaos, no aggression, tolerated whatever in Torah. However, when it comes to the Ta'avoni, when it comes to the things which are one's desires, there are the yeses and there are the noes. There are the things which are mutter, things which are permissible, and the things which are not permissible. And there one needs to know halachas. In the area of the ta'avoni, in the area of the desire, you need to know the laws. What you're allowed to and what you're not allowed to. Because it's not simple and it's not straightforward. That's halachas, that's Torah. But in kasoni, in the aggression, you don't need Torah for that, says the Rambam. To not be aggressive to others and not cause them harm, that is the basic line, the basic bottom line, not of Torah, but even before Torah. It's without that that Rabbeinu Yonah says Torah cannot possibly cleave to one. And with that, that one can start involving oneself in slowly molding one's character into the character of a Ben Torah, into the character of somebody who understands and practices Torah. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, that's Naaseh v'Nishma. Naaseh, we undertake now to keep the whole Torah. What's the whole Torah? Hillel defined it. We wouldn't do to anybody what we wouldn't want done to ourselves. V'Nishma. Now we're prepared to start learning that in the future we'll be able to practice not only those laws that restrict our aggression, but even those laws which restrict and control our desires and passions.